Hello and welcome to South Beach Sessions. This is Dan Lebatard. Coming up today, we've got one of my longest friends in the media business. I don't mean lengthwise. I mean, let me try that again. Let me
raising Dan-o.
Over. In terms of length that I've known him is what I meant. Boog Shambi, he's exceptional at what he does. And only Greg Cody.
He is.
Only Greg Cody is someone that's been a closer friend of mine in the media business. But what I wanted to get into, and when I mean close, I mean physically. I mean because we've had sex. I mean, this is an awkward way for me to say this, but I should just get it all out there, I think, at this point, given that length is what I was Freudian thinking. Anyway, the thing that I wanted to talk to him about was specifically how weird it's been covering baseball. He's great at the broadcasting of baseball, and I don't think most fans understand how hard it is to be great at that and what it takes to be great at that and what makes someone great. So I really wanted to get into sort of a how-to over the course of this South Beach session, where I'm not talking about my friendship with Boog Shambi, although you'll see where it makes some appearances. I just wanted to talk to an expert about the expertise of his craft and how weird it's been in 2020 to try and do it, and joyless, how weird and joyless it is to do it in 2020 because nothing seems normal. Here he is, one of my longest friends. Damn it, I did it again. It's because I'm thinking of his length. Boog Shambi. All right, Boog, so explain it to me, someone who doesn't understand. The difference between doing a game at the ballpark and doing one the way that you're doing it now is what? Or you've been doing it?
Yeah, I mean, technically, it's a lot harder. You just can't. When I'm at home, it's hard. We do the games, and it's basically a broadcast filtered through a Zoom feed, whether it's KBO or whether it's radio, TV games I do from Bristol, so the feed's a little bit cleaner. But either way, I'm getting a program feed, which is effectively the exact same thing you're seeing at home. So, you know, it's whatever the director gives me. And then I get like a high home feed that has, you know, all nine guys, the runners technically, but it's kind of, you know, from like the moon. So it's not lending a lot, and you're just not used to looking in spots. So like the most challenging thing is first and second and a ball headed into the gap. Where are you looking? You know, at the ballpark, I can see everything. I can look into the gap and look at the runners and look in the gap and look at the runners. And when I'm doing it this way, it's hard just trying to identify people. And that's, you know, what you're hoping to document the game. I had it happen the other day. Nobody did anything wrong, but there was a play where Mookie Betts got ran back to third and Machado tagged Betts and the play ended and the umpire wasn't in the shot. And that's fine. But like, if I'm at the ballpark, I can see the umpire and that the umpire said he was safe. So I say safe, but in this instance, I can't see the umpire. So it's Machado tags him out. And what was the call? I can't say anything. What's going on?
But you're a perfectionist though. You're a perfectionist. So that has to be maddening for you. Like,
it doesn't feel good. I mean, you have to give into it a little bit. I mean, I think, you know, you do stuff like that when you take the accidents and you turn it into something, but it doesn't feel good because you're so helpless. I mean, I think that, you know, when it goes well, you feel like you're conducting a little bit. You feel like you're conducting an orchestra as a play-by-play guy. And when it goes poorly, it's just like craziness. It's craziness.
Well, explain it to me for those who don't understand what goes into the craft, because you are somebody, you have actually become an old school baseball announcer. I can't believe I'm saying that about somebody I've known since he was in his early 20s, but you respect this thing that you do, and you do it vastly better than most who do it. So explain to people what you mean by the conducting of an orchestra.
Well, look, there's two different mediums. So I do it on radio and I'm trying to describe what I see and use the sounds in the park. And I'm trying to do it as efficiently as possible so that you can, in your mind, see what's happening on the field. So that when Mike Trout comes up to the plate, I'll say stocky right-handed hitter digs in. Well, everybody knows that Mike Trout is stocky and they know he's a right-handed hitter, but I'm basically giving you the mental cue to picture it. And when there's a ground ball out to short, and it's a routine play. You just say, you know, Seagrass stepped to his left, gathers it in, just so you're picturing it in your mind. And you're using the sounds of the ball hitting the bat, the umpire, all that stuff. And you have to have a good view and understand timing. And when your view is impaired, it makes the timing harder to execute. On TV, it's probably as much about the connection with the guys you're working with and having them next to you. And I'm someone that is going to grab the person that's next to me and ask questions. And I want it to be connective and personal. And, you know, when Chipper's in Atlanta or Sutt's in San Diego and I'm in a, you know, a 2,000 square foot studio alone in Bristol, it just, it makes it really impersonal, really disconnected. And so there's two aspects that are challenging, and that is, it is technically difficult to execute just basic aspects of what I'm trying to deliver, but then the stuff over the top, communication with the producer and the little things that, you know, make a broadcast special are really hard. Like I said, and then not being there is the other thing. I did a wild card game a couple years ago, and I'm having a conversation with Brian Cashman. Billy Beane walks up, interrupts the conversation, and says, "What's up, Cash? You guys going to out analytics the shit out of us tonight?" And like, I'm not there that anymore.
Right.
We had a, you know, like the type of dorky stuff that I do. It's look, this, I know this isn't important, but like, this is the work that goes into a 6-second piece that's kind of quirky and fun. Max Scherzer last year, game 7 of the World Series was in Houston. DH Park, AL. He took BP because he likes to take BP. It loosens up his body. And he said this year, even though the NL has the DH, he still might take BP on days that he starts just because it's just, you know, to be part of his routine, which it's not earth shattering, but it's just a quirky detail that's just kind of fun and different. Well, I mean to tell you, that first game, the Yankees are playing the Nationals, and I'm calling everyone like, "Hey, did Scherzer hit? Could you find out if Scherzer hit? Could somebody, did fucking Scherzer hit?" Like, I'm like, "Let's go." And I couldn't find out if he hit, just so that in the middle of the broadcast, I can say, "Here's the 2-2 outside 3-2. You know, Max Scherzer has an interesting thing. The NL's going to the DH park, but he's still going to take BP the day he starts. And if I was there, it would take me 2 seconds. I would just go ask someone."
That's a great story. I'm curious sort of like the musician aspect of what it is that right. You're talking about, because you're looking for the reported details, the way to tell a story, yes. The way to humanize, right. The way to make people connect in ways that are beyond baseball. Like, where does that get learned? How does it get learned? Because I don't think the listener or the viewer notices. That doesn't mean doesn't right. care, but I don't think they care the way you care. They want to just yell that Joe Buck is biased.
That's right. I mean, I had a conversation with my dad. It was unbelievable. It was the Eagles playing the Falcons, and my dad is like, "Joe Buck is rooting against the Eagles." I'm like, "Dad," I'm like, "I'm talking to Joe Buck. Like, he's not rooting against the Eagles." And then like, we go through it. I'm like, "You're just used to listening to Merrill Reese cheer for the Eagles." And he's like, "Yeah, okay, I understand." And like, we talk through this whole thing. And then it's like 2 years later, and he's like, "Joe Buck's rooting against the Eagles again." I'm like, "Dad, no, he's not." I think that, so in terms of conducting, there's two different things. On the radio, the best piece of advice I ever got was from John Miller. It's the piece of mechanical advice I give to young broadcasters. Like, baseball is the one sport where you can still really use the sounds. But the one thing that he helped me with the most is, I want any play-by-play highlight, I want you to be able to hear the ball hit the bat. So the thing he pointed out to me is that you need to say, "Here's the pitch," before you think you do. You can't say, "Here's the pitch," in sync with the pitcher throwing the ball, because the ball's faster than your voice. Meaning, you need to say, "Here's the pitch," so that there's space, and then the ball hits the bat, so that it shouldn't sound like this. It shouldn't be, "Here's if the ball hitting the bat is a clap," it shouldn't be, "Here's the pitch." It should be, "Here's the pitch," swinging a ground ball to short, picked up by Correa. Throw, you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
You're using, so that's one of the things mechanically, the timing wise. And then if you have Jim Joyce behind the plate, here's the pitch, space. The ball hit the mitt, and you use, in a well-mic'd park, you hear the umpire call it, and it's like you're conducting. You're using, you're looking at the monitor. You see, you know, Nelson Cruz hit the grand slam, and the fans want a curtain call, and I'm looking, and you're watching Nelson Cruz in the dugout, and then you see him start to come up the dugout steps, and you just say, and here he comes. And then he comes up to the stands, and then you hear the crowd go crazy.
What are the most discerning sort of compliments that you get from a fan, not a peer or not someone who understands the craft the way that you understand it or cares about it the way you care about it? What kind of things will a baseball fan say to you that are meaningful compliments to you? Because one of them with you has to be, you teach me a lot. I learn.
So that is like my fantasy. I would say I set the bar a lot lower, this is not as a throwaway. It's not saying dumb shit. Like your show as an exercise. Look, I've known Stu Gotts longer than I've known you, and like he did not just develop this ability to say dumb shit. Like it's been with him since birth. But the point is, you turn it into those happy accidents and it's fun. But I would challenge you guys, like if you did 3 hours and tried not to say dumb shit, like you really tried to say factually accurate things every time and not wander off, and it's really hard. Like sometimes there's extra space and you want to fill it, and you fill it with something that factually you're kind of sure about, but not totally sure about. So the bar for me is like when somebody's like, yeah, man, you don't say dumb stuff. Like, I'll take it. Thank you. That's what I'm looking for. I'm just looking for don't say dumb stuff.
You're so meticulous about it, though. You apply a care to it that can almost be viewed as obsessive, right? It's just caring. It's just caring deeply about what you do in a way that's probably in some ways a little bit suffocating. No?
Yeah, I think less so. I mean, you've known me for a long time when I've really struggled with the process of getting prepared, because really in the end, what it turned into is the battle of being prepared versus feeling prepared. So there was this OCD component of, you know, you're doing a Marlins game and I've been a broadcaster there for 3 years and they're playing the Pirates, and yeah, is Jason Bay sitting? He's sitting because of a knee. Is it his right knee or his left knee? And I'm like trying to find out, and I'm going back downstairs to double check whether it's his right knee or his left knee. And
it sounds like, you know, it sounds like a special kind of torture. It really does.
It's awful. It's just it's, you know what it's like. It's again I've moved on from it, but I know this is an old person's movie, but still a great, you know, you ever seen the scene in Broadcast News?
You just did the scene where it's awful. No, it must be, the line is, it must be hard being smarter than everyone
else. It must be nice knowing you're always right and everybody's always wrong. And Holly Hunter says, no, that's awful.
You look at what's happened with the distorted form of baseball announcing now. And when you're done with work, is it possible to feel fulfilled by it? To feel like you've conducted the orchestra correctly?
Just be careful. Be gentle with me right now. I'm not even kidding. It's been really hard. I get like this sport. There's interesting right now. What they're producing on the field is not great, even though the players are great. You know, there's the ball's not in play enough, just editorial comment. But in terms of executing it, I just get so much in terms of the people that I see, the interactions that I have. You know, like I got one small one where Bob Melvin on a Zoom call was like, okay, I know you like this stuff. I'll let you do it. And I'm like, give me your superstition. He's like, I eat one piece of candy when we hit before the first inning, when we hit before the third inning, before the fifth, the seventh, and in the ninth. And in the ninth, it's always green. And I'm like, what? And then he's like, and I'm like, well, what if it goes to extra innings? He's like, then I have to run up to the clubhouse. And I'm like, seriously? And I'm like, well, what's the candy? He's like, I'm not going there. I'm not telling you what the candy is. I was like, okay. And then I said, well, what do you take it on the road? And he's like, let's just say on the road, the candy choices aren't as good. And I just can't, you can't get that stuff. And so, but the connection of being there with Bob, to, you know, I've known, I mean, look, that's where you and I met. It's 1993, 94. I've been doing this a long time. I've met a lot of people. I'm like an old person in the game now. But I, it's my home, going to the ballpark every day and seeing these players. And good Lord, I was like, David Bodie, serious as a heart attack. I asked him to, for the, he's a, you know, reserved for the Cubs. I asked him to do the Sunday night pregame interview. He's like, wow, I grew up listening to you. I was like, wow, punch me in the face. So, but it, you know, a super compliment, but I just, I'm used to the connection, to the connecting to my work people, to Chipper, to Sut, to Jeff Dufine, who's, you know, my former producer, or Scott Gustafson, Chris Singleton and Justin Ware. I spent so, I mean, worked with Chris for 10 years now. And so, I mean, again, you know what it's like, so it's the same in terms of doing it from your house and not having Mike actually on the other side of the glass, that, or, you know, Stu Gott's not being there and those guys.
Well, I've honestly wondered, Boog, even married, I have all, and just recently married with all the happiness that entails, I've wondered what would be the status of my mental health right now if I did not have the daily connection of coming in here and seeing Stu Gatz and Mike, because everything's been turned upside down. And I would imagine that that absence of connection, that you're speaking for a whole bunch of weird, clunky loneliness that has existed in this pandemic for a whole lot of people.
Look, I understand. I'm not saying it, feel sorry for me. I'm saying it as this is just what it is. Like, I have a great job. I get it. I will tell you this right now. The amount of guys I've talked, like, I'm not enjoying it right now. I'm not enjoying doing this. Watching games on, like, in a dark studio and then a lit studio on a television, I mean, I'd rather be binge watching The Wire. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to make me watch TV for that long, like, I lose the connection and the fulfillment in that regard. And there's just that social component. So the ironic part is that the hard part of my gig is the travel, and that's been eliminated. And this is way harder.
Well, I was just going to ask you because, at the end of every season, because it's just a nightmare, grueling thing of travel. You are a guy, right, who's got so many frequent flyer miles that you arrive in Hawaii and a Porsche picks you up on the tarmac, right? Because you're a special kind of flyer. What have they done for you on one of those flights?
If you have a certain type of status, you'll get off. This is true. I'm trying to think the most recent. It was a weird, I was coming from like Iowa or something, and I was connecting. I don't remember where I was coming from, but I was connecting.
You never do, Boog, because you travel so much. It's San Francisco one day and New York the next, and red eyes
and Burlington, but you're getting off the plane. It's not at the top of the jetway. It's like as you get off the plane, and there's a guy with a sign that says Mr. Shambi, and he takes you onto the tarmac and he puts you into a Porsche Cayenne and drives you to your gate because your gate's going to be because you're going to be late. So that's my Delta status. I've said, for Coming to America fans, I've said my next status level is those ladies will be following me around throwing rose petals at my feet. That's the next level.
Have they embarrassed you like on the intercom and it's made you both happy and sad? You're a George Clooney movie because you're like, Mr. Shambi, congratulations.
It's happened once or twice. Yeah, it has, you know.
And thank you for our diamond medallion. Also, special thanks to Boog Skiambi.
Yeah, that's right.
There it is. That's a very good impersonation. But what I was going to say to you is that at the end of one of these grueling, grueling seasons, you're always exhausted and super fired up for the playoffs. And it sounds like you just want the season to end. Like,
A little bit. I like the playoffs for me. I mean, I'm 50, and the playoffs for me are still doing the playoffs. It's like Christmas morning. It is. I am that excited to get a chance to do these games on this stage. It's super exciting. And to do it from a studio in Bristol, it's not the same. It's not what it doesn't for me deliver the thing. I mean, there's so many aspects of this year that have been different, right? But it's just, in all honesty, like, I mean, once I'm there, but like thinking about it right now, it does not stir me. Thinking about calling David Ortiz Grand Slam in the 2013 LCS gets me excited and makes me think, God, I'd like to be at Fenway Park with a lot of fans there. But thinking about starting on Tuesday or Wednesday and doing a TV series and not being there bums me out. It makes me sad. So
how does this work when you talk about your home, when you talk about family? I don't think people sort of understand how deep that runs, walking into a manager's office and just seeing a familiar face. Like, can you explain to us the morsels of humanity that get lost under, because you say there are 1,000 ways that this is different, but I'm just curious, like, what are some of the specific, just laughing, right? Laughing around a batting cage.
There's so much laughing. There's so much laughing. There's so much people making fun of it's me doing the Maui Classic with Bill Walton in November and walking into a clubhouse and Todd Frazier running up to me and being like, dude, what's up with you and Bill Walton? Like, and just the amount of, like, you know, who are you doing the game with? You know, Sut, and someone making a funny comment at Sut. It's, yeah, at this point, it is like my home. It feels like the place that I'm supposed to be. And like, you know, people ask, have you worked with people you don't like? I really haven't. I mean, especially in the baseball world, I've been lucky that I've worked with people and we get to have fun. Like, one of the things, I'll tell you, one of the things that's, it's been great because Chipper, I think, has a chance to be really good at this, but I really wish he was next to me because I think he would be improving by leaps and bounds as opposed to be, you know, sitting in shorts and a jacket and tie in his house thousands of miles away from me. But just the laughing and telling stories. And if we say, you know, like, David Ross, I worked with him for 3 years and we worked together with Rick Sutcliffe and we had a great chemistry and he just had fun where, you know, like I mean, I caught a little bit in college before they cut me. And like, if a catcher makes a good block, a lot of times I'd be like, ooh, nice block. Like, as part of the play by play. And at a certain point, David Ross is like, why don't you let me handle that? Okay. On the air, which is perfect. Yes. You know, like that type of stuff. Or we did an extra inning game in Boston a couple of years ago and Rossi had to get up, to go to the bathroom at the end of 9. And when he came back, we were already on the air and he puts his headset on, you know, kind of like he's sneaking into the room. And Sut, who's not the cleverest cat on the planet, I'll give him credit for this one. As soon as Rossi puts his headset on, we weren't talking about anything, but as soon as his headset comes on, Sut says, that's a great point. What do you think about that, Rossi? And then we both just stare at him. And it's like, it was like 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000. And he just burst out, you guys never go to the bathroom. You're like camels. Yeah. So that camaraderie I miss. I just do.
The compliment that a peer can give you that is meaningful. It's not as low. Your bar is not as low as it is for just don't say dumb shit, right? Like that someone is noticing sort of the sculpting that you do and the art in what you do.
Yeah, I can't think of one that comes to mind.
The reason I asked the question is because I can't imagine you run into a lot of people who are A, as good at this as you are, and B, who care about the particulars of this the way you do. So if they're noticing, like if I were to compliment you as a broadcaster, it wouldn't be for the accents, for the framing, for the orchestra conducting. It would be because you have been at the forefront of teaching people about baseball analytics before it was popular, about the measurements that mattered. So whenever I was listening to you doing a broadcast, I was actively absorbing, getting smarter about what I was watching. I can't pay a broadcaster a better compliment than that.
It's an awesome compliment. It is truly an awesome compliment. Hey, look, the Chipper Jones story that we told that got a lot of attention, that was really fun and funny with him staring up at me. It started from a place of analytics. It started with me going to Fangraphs and seeing that he's seen the second lowest percentage of first pitch strikes. And that's, it was like putting coins in a machine.
Let me stop you. Let me stop you. Tell the story. Just go ahead and tell the story for the audience that might not know the story, because it's a great story. And if you haven't seen the photograph, it's a great picture, the punchline on the story.
And we told it on the air last year with full video, and it was amazing. Yeah. So it's 2009 and Chipper is not swinging it great. And I was looking at some numbers and I felt like he was rolling over to second on, you know, like hitting ground balls to second, swinging at the first pitch a lot. So I looked at Fangraphs and it said he saw the second fewest first pitch strikes in the majors. So I went to him with that information and he was kind of surprised by that. Now, remember, this is still 2009. So, you know, data is not as freely available. But his explanation was simply this. I swing at the first pitch a lot because it's probably the only time I'm going to get a fastball. And I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't seem like it's a strike. And he's like, yeah, but like that's the pitch. A heater is the pitch that I do damage on. And then we had to break the conversation up. He goes and takes BP and he comes up to hit for the first time. We're in San Diego and he's facing Tim Stauffer. And Tim Stauffer throws him a 91 mile an hour fastball that splits the plate. And he steps out and he just stares at me. Like, you see,
you
that's
asshole.
Why I swing at that pitch.
You asshole.
You asshole. And then you can see him like shaking his head. And when we had him in the booth, he said, you dictated the at bat to me. And I said, for those that care, we walked that at bat. Like we came back and walked. I'm like, you know, I know our skill set. So, but it was. And then when he came off the field, he was waving at me like, get out of here with that crap. But I mean, he legitimately like interacted with me, just looking up at me like, you see? So it was, and the way it played out was just, I don't know that I've ever laughed that hard. Like I was out him staring up at me.
But you've taught him, right? That's the one of the amazing things. Never mind teaching me. That's one thing. Like, who cares? You taught me to learn a little more about baseball while I'm listening to your broadcast. You taught Chipper Jones something that he did not know. Chipper Jones is now an analytics guy, is he not? Chipper Jones can actually reference something like Fangraphs, which he would have been a bumpkin who would have laughed you out of the room at one point as just being naturally skillful and not needing your bullshit analytics.
So, like, look, I'm naturally curious. I'm not that bright math wise and like I owe it to the Rob Nyers and guys like that who taught me. But yeah, I mean, like the other day, you know, he was tiptoeing around the, you know, for as much people were talking about Tatis and Betts winning an LMVP, he was kind of like, you know, Freddie Freeman's having a really good year. And then I sent him a thing, you know, that had like where Freeman was with F war, Fangraphs war, Baseball Reference war, and some other advanced analytics, and he tweeted it out. He's like, I'm going to post this. And he tweeted it out and it just took off and everybody's like, Chipper Jones loves sabermetrics. And I was like, I mean, but that's the thing though, Dan, like if you really get down to it, for that stuff to really get digested, unfortunately, it has to come from Chipper Jones. Like it has to come from a player to cross that bridge. That's the way that it'll, because like, if he and I are going to get into an argument over the value of RBIs to the mass audience, even if my argument's better, I'm going to lose it because he is Chipper Jones. But if he decides that RBIs are dumb or not a great evaluative tool, then we'll gain some ground.
Boog, one of the things that I have found fascinating, and I don't know how much you think about this, but conversationally, I remember 10 years ago, some of these guys who are now managers, like Craig Counsell, I remember 10 years ago, you making the argument on behalf of how everyone is now using their bullpens, that back then they would look at you like you were some sort of crazy person. Like you've got stories about managers and coaches just not understanding what you were saying because a closer closes and that's it.
Yeah.
And the whole game has changed in that regard. Like the evolution of the sport in that regard has been fascinating.
It has. The bullpens are weaponized now. You know, for as much as pitchers rarely go 100 pitches, I mean, I think 10 years ago, this is rough, but 10 years ago, about 50% of starts, the pitcher went 100 or more pitches. So 10 years ago, it was 50% of the time, 100 or more pitches. Last year, it was 25%. This year, it's 12%. So what's happening is two things. They're being taught and trained to go as hard as they can for 100 pitches and then beat it. We don't want you to throw the BP fastball that might get hit 7,000 feet. We want you to step on the gas and throw as many as you can, as hard as you can. That's one of the things. And then, you know, it used to be back in 03, 04 with those Red Sox and Yankees teams, if you got to the bullpen in the fifth or the sixth inning, you know, some turd throwing 87 miles an hour with a sinker and a slider was coming in, and those teams would just bludgeon him. Well, now when the bullpen door opens up and you go in the fifth and the sixth, it's some guy going, wait, how do you pronounce his name? Throwing 99. You know what I mean? So that's the difference, is the bullpens are weaponized now. That's for sure. And you're seeing, you know, more teams do that. It's just it's harder to hit now than it ever has been.
Well, you do a great Jim Leland impersonation. Do you know the one I'm referencing that is Al Fonseca related? Because Al Fonseca also came out of the bullpen often throwing 97, 98. But give the people a little bit of your finest Jim Leland.
Well, I'm not going to say who the player was. One of the best was, I keep asking them for ball players. They keep giving me truck drivers. This guy's a f-ing truck driver. And then I love my bullpen. They're great. I'd like to take them all out to dinner and release them. Greg Zahn came into the manager's office. I think he stole a base. Might have stolen two. We're going to say it's a base. And he said, what'd you think, Skip? Pretty good speed. Maybe give me the green light. And Leland said, okay, Zonny, if I jump up in the air and don't come down, you go. So that was,
What was the pitcher that he would reference, though? Because I'm betraying the confidence now, because I've heard him tell the story about specifically Al Fonseca. But who was was it Gibson? Who was he talking about on the front end of that, where he's like, somebody throws 91?
Right.
What is that story?
Well, he, like, just being on the bus and just, he would just name, he would go over, like, the velocity, and that he didn't give a crap about the velocity. He'd be like, Bob Gibson, 92, struck him out. And then he'd name, like, a reliever and on the Marlins, and then it would be like, 97, upper deck. And just, yeah, he was as unbelievably funny as anyone.
Can you explain to the audience, in terms of understanding what it is that you do for a living, like who you look at and say, if anybody, that person just does all of the elements of my craft, just does that better than any of us do?
I mean, there's tons of them. Dave Fleming's awesome. I love Jason Benetti. I think Jason Benetti is so unbelievably talented. Fun, funny, you know, there's just some playfulness there. Lennon JD with the Cubs, Kruko and Kipe, with the Giants. And obviously, I mean, that crew is pretty special with John Miller and Dave Fleming doing the radio. I love the Mets group as well. With Gary, Ron, and Keith.
What are you looking at? What are you? Because you said the specifics of fun and funny, but like, what are you looking for when you're doing critique work?
I also think this. So the one point that I would make is my job, regardless, it's a little different as a national guy as opposed to a local guy. People get used to hearing their guy, and they don't. One of the things that's funny about fandom to me is that on the one hand, if your team is not, if you just put it in terms of your team football wise, if your receiver drops a pass, you're sitting there MFing your receiver. But if the national announcer does it, we got a problem with the national announcer. So there's an aspect of it where you're used to your local guys, and the slant is, it's part of why Jason Bay, if I'm doing a Marlins broadcast, it doesn't really matter whether it's his right or his left knee from a, I'm doing the Marlins broadcast. Like, we can tell people that his knee's hurt. Okay. But it doesn't, from a national standpoint, that becomes a little more important. So there's different things. I think connecting with the audience, what I'm trying to do is I want my national broadcast to feel more local. I want it to be less, you know, Ted Baxter, stiff, you know, button down type broadcast. I want it to be looser and connect with the audience and be more personal. So, I mean, again, there are plenty of guys that are, you know, good and young and curious, like, you know, Aaron Goldsmith in Seattle. And I mean, look, Len and I looking at this stuff for a long time and just trying to learn. And I think the access to the baseball people is a big thing. I don't think everybody gets how good Joe Buck is at just the craft of the job, that there is an element. I mean, I did the KBO in the morning, and that thing was like, I described it as, it was like 3.5 hours of log rolling. And every once in a while, they'd throw me some chainsaws and be like, here you go. And I mean, that's one where.
That's the hardest thing. Korean baseball at 5:30 in the morning is the hardest thing you've ever done professionally. And you were working minor league baseball at one point.
No doubt. It was just, I mean, to really do it. Yeah. It's just so, and I don't think people get, I love Joe Buck when he lays out that he doesn't talk and he's smart. I think he's funny. I don't feel like Joe is trying to put his imprint on it. He's just doing the game. And I think he's a very special broadcaster. I think what ends up happening is this. The way people process announcers, in my opinion, is it's very much like ice cream. And that is, they put it in their mouth and it's, how does it taste? And it's either yes or no, and that's it. It's overall, usually the fans are not overly discerning on, this guy's good because of X, Y, and Z, and this guy's bad because of A, B, C.
Buddy, it's always good catching up with you. Next time we'll tell personal stories that...
Personal.
That will betray my confidences in you because you will embarrass me publicly on my own podcast. But this,
I like
was,
that. I think America would sign up for that.
Yes,
I think
for sure.
We'd need to take out a billboard ahead of time for that one.
Yeah, that would get some attention. Thank you, buddy.
Maybe good in Cleveland.
Good talking to you.